Hi, this is episode 53 of K. Ray Reads to You. Today we have chapter 3 of The Apple Stone by Nicholas Stewart Gray. Chapter 3 is called Lost, One Old Rug. A good deal of this was my fault. We had a long discussion over breakfast. Being Saturday, we didn't have to go to school, so we took plenty of time to thrash the matter out properly. And we all agreed not to use the apple stone unless everyone was present and approving. This way we could make quite sure we did nothing silly. We all felt strong-minded, intelligent, and far-seeing. After all, said Douglas, through a mouthful of marmalade, we could set everybody by the ears if we chose. We could do some frightful things. He sounded a bit wistful. I said coldly that he would do nothing frightful while I was watching him. He said there was no law against thinking. I said there ought to be for some people. And what's more, I said, I'm going to take charge of the apple stone myself. Missy burst into loud protests. So did the clans. Jeremy didn't mean, we do trust you, said Joe soothingly, all of you. I said, as far as a seasick mouse could throw an elephant. The meeting broke up. When we got up to the attics, Joe hurried to feed Mrs. Blossom. She's a lovely-looking cat, pale gray and white, but she has an odd temper and a quick paw. Joe found her when she was a lost kitten, and now she has a kitten of her own. As I see it, there's no reason why we shouldn't end up with about 500 gray and white fiends. Anyway, while she was eating her fish and hissing at Joe, the rest of us went on discussing the apple stone. "Let's do my centurion tank," said Douglas. "What about when it falls through the floor?" said Nigel. "We'll take it out to the road first, then drive it through the village," said Douglas eagerly. "Give everyone a terrific surprise. They wouldn't know it was us inside." "They'd think it was soldiers and a war," said Missy. "Who's going to drive?" I asked. Douglas got extremely passionate, assuring us that one glance at a dashboard would make anyone, especially himself, the world's expert on tank driving. He fell over the rug and hit his head on the table. Nigel laughed. Douglas grabbed his leg and dragged him down, too. He hit his head on the table. We managed to separate them. "That was aggression," I told Douglas, "and I've warned you about it."
"It was the rug did the aggressing," said he.
"Rubbish! You fell over it, being silly, and then attacked Nigel." He laughed. "Because a mangy, rotten, moth-eaten old sheepskin..."
"Bearskin," said Joe.
"It's a deerskin, actually," I said. "Mother brought it down from Bremer."
"Uncle Neil shot it in India, I'm almost certain," insisted Joe.
Missy cut into the conversation.
"It's a lamb, poor little thing. It must have died of something."
"Yes," I said, "a bullet at Bremer."
"In India!"
"I'll tell you what it is. It's a wolf," said Nigel. "My father gave it to yours, Jeremy, ages ago, and he had it given to him when he was in Denmark or somewhere."
"When was your father in Denmark?" Douglas demanded hotly.
I was wondering that myself. Nigel does tend to make things up. He says it's to add interest to the conversation.
"I said, or somewhere," he told Douglas.
"I bet anyone sixpence it's a deer," I said. We examined the rug, but it was too faded and squashed and worn to be recognized as anything in particular. I noticed suddenly that Missy was holding the apple stone on the palm of her hand and looking thoughtful.
"Hey, just a minute," I said.
"I know it's a lamb," she said crossly. "I just know." And she stamped her foot, and the apple stone fell with a thud on the rug. Looking back, I'm almost sure I could have caught it before it touched the ground, and that I hesitated from sheer curiosity. I was convinced I was right, and that it was a deer.
There was a furry, fuzzy upheaval from the floor, and something streaked out of the attic like a flash. "Oh, no," I said, "not again." I took a deep breath and looked at Missy. She looked back defiantly. "It was an accident," said she. "I dropped it by accident." Well, I'm not saying she didn't. I couldn't be certain, and no one likes to accuse their little sister of telling lies or breaking promises, but... "It was a lamb," said she. "No lamb ever went that fast," said Joe. There was a pause. Missy picked up the apple stone. I suddenly remembered what the stone had said about reviving the dead. Surely a skin rug was... "Jeremy," said Joe, It may be a wolf." "Or a bear," said Nigel, fair-mindedly. I said, whatever it was, we'd got to find it. "Yes," said Douglas, "it may be eating people." We didn't go very quickly, but we did go. It wasn't in the house. The back door was open, and Mrs. Chug said something had gone through the kitchen. She thought it was Ragnar, but the Dane was in his basket by the fire, and he rolled his eyes and wouldn't come out. Later, meeting Joe in the orchard, I said, "I am not going to spend the rest of my life looking for oddments that Missy has let loose with the stone, and so I tell you." "We'll take it away from her," said my sister. "One of us will keep it. You're right, Jeremy. She's too young to know what she's doing." "She knows quite well what she's doing, and in my opinion she's a monster and as crooked as they come. So's Douglas. He's raving mad, and he eggs her on." Joe managed to calm me after a while. Then I had a thought that uncalmed me again. I said, "We mustn't let her out of sight. She may be doing something with the stone now." We rushed off to find Jemima, and we found her. She was sitting on a gate in the lane, looking at a field with some sheep in it. She said her lamb had gone in there to find its mother. I said, if it was a lamb, which I doubted, its mother would be about 100 years old by now. "It was about 90 itself," I added. "But you said it was a deer that Mother brought from Braemar," said Missy. "I didn't say how long it had been there." "If it was a bear Uncle Neil shot, it couldn't be more than 30," said Joe. "Even so," I said, "it isn't going looking for its mother in a load of sheep." Then Douglas came shouting across the field and sent the flock scattering in all directions. "It's a leopard! I saw it!" he panted wildly as he came to us. "Up on the moor! All spots and that!" "Are you certain?" said Joe worriedly. "I left Nigel stalking it. He saw it too." "Who saw it first?" I asked. It would be like Nigel to introduce an imaginary leopard into the proceedings, but Douglas assured us that he'd seen it before Nigel did. "I was going to get Ragnar to track it," said he, "but I remembered that leopards like dogs. To eat. Come to think of it," he added ghoulishly, "there's a lot of things they like to eat." I wished he wouldn't harp on this theme, and as we crossed a meadow and made our way to the open moors, I can't honestly say we hurried. The bracken was gold and red in the October sunshine, but we weren't in the mood to admire the scenery. We stared around apprehensively at the long rolling upland. Only a few sheep were grazing quietly some way away. Then something came crawling from behind a clump of gorse. Joe gave a shrill yelp. It turned out to be Nigel. "Shh," said he, "it's over there." And he pointed to an isolated group of trees not far off. "What's it doing?" I said. "Washing its face." There was a pause. Joe said, "Why couldn't we just leave the thing alone, and it would turn into a rug again when we went to sleep that night?" "What will it be doing till then?" I said. Suddenly, the sheep began to bleat and walk quickly away. "Maybe the leopard wants its lunch," said Douglas. "Oh, shut up," I snapped. "Jeremy, we'll have to try to stop it," said Joe. "It does belong to us in a way, and you know what everyone's like about sheep worrying." I knew. There had been suggestions once that Ragnar, but nothing came of them, because I said I'd been with him at the time of suspicion. "It's dogs that worry sheep, not leopards," said Missy. I said I bet they'd worry more if attacked by a leopard. But the flock had stopped again and was grazing peacefully. We went toward the grove with a good deal of caution. When we got near and nothing had come pouncing out, we all dropped into the bracken and began to crawl in the proper stalking manner. Nigel, crawling beside me, said suddenly, "What happens when we catch up with it? We haven't a gun. And besides, can you shoot an animated hearthrug? I mean, doesn't it come under witchcraft and need a silver bullet or something?" Trust Nigel to start getting practical about a completely crazy situation. Not only that, he was scarcely stuttering at all. He doesn't when something really nerve-wracking happens, which is odd. "We'll think about that when we come to it," I said vaguely. "It may be asleep, and we can keep watch and ward all night, and then all dash to the house and go to sleep ourselves." "What will Mrs. Chug do when we don't come in to lunch?" whispered Joe, crawling a bit to our left. I said I didn't know, and had more things to worry about than Mrs. Chug. "Well, don't worry," said Missy from behind us. "It'll be tame, you'll see, and it'll eat out of our hands."
"Eat the hands, more like," said Douglas.
The crawling slowed down all around. In fact, we halted completely and sat up and looked at the grove with some nervousness. Then we heard a shout. Three men were coming toward us across the moor, three men with guns.
"Hey, you kids!" bawled one.
It was a farmer called Dobbs. He was a big, burly man with a soft voice and the largest mustache I'd ever seen. It was he who'd accused Ragnar of sheep worrying, and we hadn't forgiven him.
"What are you doing?" he shouted now.
I said we'd been having a walk. It was true, in a way. He told us to go home at once.
"There's a wild beast escaped from Ilfracombe Zoo," said he, "and it'll do in the lot of you if it comes on you."
"It's tame," said Missy. He said it might seem so in a cage.
"But not running loose," he went on, standing over us and scowling at us. "It's ate one little boy," he said, "over at Muddiford."
"No," said Joe in a wail.
My knees felt limp. I said, "Are you sure?"
He said he was perfectly sure.
"Didn't it, Dick?" he appealed to one of the other men, who nodded.
"That's right," said the third man solemnly.
"So you'd best be off, the whole bunch of you," growled Mr. Dobbs. You don't want getting mixed up with tigers."
"It's a leopard," said Douglas.
"Been hearing tales, have you?" said the farmer. "Thought you'd come and help search, did you? Well, you ought to know better."
Missy said she wasn't afraid, even if he was, and all the men grinned. The third one, the little old weather-beaten one called Weber, said,
"Ah, you're a proper hero. You just take your little sister and brothers home and see they don't come to no harm."
We were all offended, even Missy. But before we could speak, Weber went on, "Now, I'm not joking entirely, my dears." And Mr. Dobbs, frowning blackly, said he wasn't joking at all.
"Off with you," said he, "and leave us to settle the old tiger."
"Leopard," said Douglas.
"Have you seen it yourself, Mr. Dobbs?" asked Nigel.
"Yes, indeed, son," said the farmer. "It come running through my farmyard, and all the dogs howling." And then he added sternly, "Has any of you seen it?"
"Yes," said Joe and Missy and Douglas.
"No," said Nigel and I.
We all spoke together, and the three men looked at us a bit sourly.
"This isn't a game," said Mr. Dobbs. "There's a lot of people out after this beast, police and soldiers and all, and if you don't get yourself eaten, you may get shot by mistake."
"Not on purpose," said Douglas. Dobbs told us, even more harshly, to stop playing the fool and get up and go home. Then the three men went striding off over the moor, looking grim and purposeful, with their guns aslant over their shoulders. They were going away from the grove. We relaxed.
"Why did you say you hadn't seen it, Jeremy?" said Joe.
"I haven't."
"Yes, you did, in the attic."
"Not in its present form."
"Well, Nigel saw it," said my sister accusingly, "and he said he hadn't, too."
"I don't like Dobbs,"
said Nigel simply.
"Who hasn't seen it himself?" put in Douglas. "He says it's a tiger, and it isn't."
"And apart from all that," I said, "I wonder where it is now."
It sat up among some nearby ferns and yawned, and it was a leopard.
Missy recovered first. She held out her hand and said, "Hello, Ruggy, come here then."
It came. We were all too stunned to make the slightest move, but Missy patted it.
"There," said she in triumph, "it is a lamb, in a sort of way."
She was right, in a sort of way. It was very lamb-like leopard. It was a very lamb-like leopard. I suppose because of all those long years of being trodden on and sat on and brushed and spilled over. We sat in a circle with it sitting in the middle, and Missy had her arm around its neck, and it purred at us. He was a big beast, about the size of Ragnar, and his coat was much nicer than it had been as a rug. Tawny gold he was, and dappled with beautiful rosettes. Tawny gold he was, and dappled with beautiful dark rosettes, in definite rows all over him, even on his white stomach and throat. His eyes were golden, too, and he had long, white, curving whiskers. When I stroked these, they lifted upward as though the beast was smiling. Maybe he was. He couldn't have been more affable, for all his huge white teeth. He was like a gentle cat, which is just about what he was. We patted him and rubbed his chin, and the leopard rolled on his back and waved his big feet in the air, still purring his head off.
"Let's call it Lammy," said Missy, and he licked her ear until she giggled.
I said, "What about lunch? If we didn't go back, someone might come looking for us. Not our parents, because they were in Exeter, recording. But Mrs. Chug might easily."
"I'll go and get some sandwiches," offered Joe. "It's a nice day, so she won't think it's odd. We can't take, Lammy home, and we can't go off and leave him alone here. He might get shot by beastly old Dobbs. One of you come with me, and the rest stay with him. You'd better go into that grove," she added, "and keep quiet."
Nigel got up, and they went off together. We took Lambie into the grove.
"What about keeping a lookout," said Douglas to me, "in case Dobbs comes back, or the police and that, and has a shot at our leopard? Maybe it really did eat someone in Muddiford," he said hopefully.
If Douglas had an animal in tow, he wanted a lethal one. We looked at Lambie, lying with his great head on Missy's knee. He didn't look very lethal, I decided thankfully, and Missy said if he'd eaten anyone, they deserved to be. I felt she'd missed the point. Douglas and I climbed to the top of the one pine that stood solitary among the birches, and we sat on a branch that gave us a clear view over the surrounding moor. It was nice up there. The pine resin smelled hot and soothing, though tending to come off stickily on our hands and clothes. And it was a very good thing we were keeping a lookout. We hadn't been up there long before old Grandma Weber came in sight. She was no relation to the man who'd been with Dobbs. There are lots of Webers in Devon. Maybe they're all some sort of distant relatives. Anyway, this one was a strange old thing who lived alone in a remote cottage at the edge of the moor and was very shy with people. I once heard someone say she was a witch, but I didn't think they were serious. When she saw us, she waved and shouted, "Hello there, my dears! Getting primroses, are you?" It would have been a funny place to do it, and a funny time of year, but I only called back that we were having a rest. She smiled and nodded and went on past us. Then she stopped. She stared back across her shoulder at the grove. She looked extremely odd, with wisps of white hair blowing in the wind, her thick gray dress and sweater, and her old, old pretty face. She said softly, "Pussy, pussy, pussy." Down below us, the leopard's head lifted quickly. "Down," I hissed. "Pussy," sang old Mrs. Weber again.
"There isn't a cat here," shouted Douglas.
The old lady looked bewildered.
"Oh, isn't there?" said she. "I was sure I felt a pussy cat nearby."
"There was," said Douglas, "but he went away."
"Ah, that would have been my Skippy," said Mrs. Weber. "Did he say where he was going?"
"To the Cornish's barn," I called, "to steal the farm cat's milk." This was almost true. I had seen Skipper there as we came by earlier. The old lady laughed. "Thank you, love," said she. "I like to know him busy and happy." And off she went, along the almost invisible track across the moor. I don't know where she was going. People said she looked for buried treasure and gathered strange herbs, but all I ever saw her look for and gather was firewood and blackberries. Sometimes we collected these for her and put them by her door. We liked her. Then I thought of something nasty and wished I hadn't. Once, not so long ago upon a time, people would probably have chucked stones at a lonely old lady living with her cat, ducked her and tortured her and burned her, and her cat, too. Except that they didn't ever burn witches in England unless they poison someone, but then people always do think they're poisoned if they eat too much or pick a toadstool by mistake. And is hanging all that much better than burning anyway? Jeremy! It came to me that Douglas had been shouting for some time. I found he'd gone down from the tree and was helping Missy sit on the leopard. "Wake up, Jeremy!" bawled Missy. "Lammy wants to chase Mrs. Webber." I went down, but as I reached the ground, Lammy rolled over on his side and then rolled his head in a winsome sort of way. He seemed contented enough. "He's better now," said Douglas, idly pulling the leopard's tail. "But he was mad keen to go galloping after the old girl." "He liked her," said Missy. "Wants his lunch," said our cousin darkly. Whatever he wanted, Lammy gave up any thought of leaving us for the time being, and this was just as well. The three of us combined couldn't have held him if he'd made up his mind to go. Instead, he let us play with him. We tried to train him to jump through a hoop that we made from twisted twigs. He very nearly did it, only the hoop wasn't quite big enough, and he sat there with it around his neck, looking a bit surprised and growling to himself. Douglas told him to shut up, and he did. I dragged the hoop off him, and he rubbed himself against me till I nearly fell over with his weight. Then Joe and Nigel came back with the sandwiches. It wasn't a big grove, and by sitting in a fairly wide circle we could keep an eye out all around. It was very quiet, except for a few bees humming in the sunshine, and once or twice the jet planes ripping the sky across with a noise like tearing canvas as they flashed toward or away from Barnstaple. There was no sign of anyone out hunting for the so-called tiger. I wondered why they thought he was a tiger. Someone must have had the merest glimpse and started the rumor. We divided our sandwiches with our former rug. He liked the beef ones best. So did I, but I didn't cheat, and he got his fair share. Then he went to sleep, flat on the ground, with his paws crossed, snoring slightly. It made me feel sleepy myself just to look at him. Nigel yawned. Silence fell on the grove. I got a frightful turn when Douglas shook me violently. I yelped, and he put a hand over my mouth. I gurgled. "Shh, Jeremy, wake up, do," he hissed. Then he removed his hand, and I said indignantly that I was wide awake, thank him very much, and what on earth was he playing at? He said we were surrounded. I said, by what? "Soldiers and men coming close." "What shall we do?" said Joe across his shoulder. Her face was as white as paper. She's a fairly law-abiding sort of girl, as a rule, but now she looked grim and determined and terrified all at the same time. "We must get Lammy away," she said. "If an animal is involved, my sister will fight to the last ditch." I rolled over and looked out of the grove and saw a line of men spread over the moor, coming slowly toward us. "There are more at this side," said Nigel, in a piercing whisper from the far edge of the birches. "They are closing in." I could see the uniforms of policemen and soldiers. "They're beating the moor properly," said Douglas, under his breath. "They're making a mistake," I said. "They think it's a savage tiger escaped from the zoo. We must go out and tell them." "Don't be silly," snapped Joe. "Can you see them when you start up about the applestone and the attic rug? Think of something sensible." "Jeremy, don't let them hurt Lammy," begged Missy. "Stop them." She was clutching the leopard as close as an 8-year-old could possibly clutch so large a creature. Not for the first time, I wished they wouldn't all turn so hopefully to me whenever some really dreadful crisis arose. "If I crawl out," said Joe tensely, "perhaps they'll follow me and—" "I'll crawl the opposite way," said Douglas, "and growl loudly, and then they won't know who to shoot." "I'll go and point at you," began Nigel. "No, no," I said. Then the thought came to me, and I was very glad to get it. "There's a deep, dry brook running from just outside these trees to the wood over there," I told the others, "and plenty of bracken to hide us crawling into it. If we go now..." We went then. Another 10 seconds, and someone would have seen us as we wriggled through the bracken into the little ravine. In normally wet weather, this would have contained a swift-running brook, but now it held only a thin trickle of water, and us. We had to go on all fours. The leopard was on all fours anyway, in a manner of speaking, and he was the only one who didn't find it tiring. He wouldn't. In fact, he showed a tendency to think we were playing, and to frolic about. I slapped him, and told him in a hiss to behave himself. He gave an excited coughing bark, and Joe hissed at him too, and he subsided. He walked along rather sedately, casting puzzled looks at our rapidly crawling line from time to time, until we reached the wood. I was the last to wriggle into the shelter of the big trees, and I looked back to see what was going on behind us. The line of men had got to the grove and was just going in with guns at the ready. I shivered. I've always hated people who hunt things, because I've always thought I knew how the hunted would feel. Now I did know. It was even worse than I'd thought. I heard someone whispering my name urgently. I caught up with Douglas, who was waiting for me. "If only this was a huge forest," he said. "But it isn't. It's quite small, and they'll come here next." "They may not." "Why not?" I couldn't think of any reason why not, so I told him to shut up and run. We got to the big dead tree in the very middle of the wood, where we'd often held meetings and picnics and such, and here we stopped and panted and gasped and looked at one another with alarm and despondency. Joe was almost in tears of worry and fury. We'd been fond enough of our leopard during all the years he'd been our hearthrug, and now we loved him dearly. And in the distance were men who carried guns and wouldn't think twice about killing him. I wondered what would happen if they did. Would he suddenly turn into a rug again in front of their startled eyes? And then, if we used the apple stone and made him a leopard again, would they shoot again? And then, if... "Let's burrow into some bushes," said Joe, "and keep dead still and quiet, and maybe no one will come poking around too closely." "Some of the men had dogs," said Nigel, in a voice of doom. "Leopards like dogs," said Douglas. "Douglas?" "You said that before," I told him snappishly, "and it wasn't funny then." "It wasn't meant to be." "Let's go up a tree," said Missy. I said if she thought a lot of grown men were going to miss seeing all five of us and a great shining leopard sitting in a row on the branch of a tree like starlings. A man came out of the shadows of the wood and stared at us. We froze. "Pussy," he said. The leopard sprang at him. "Heel," I said, shutting my eyes. I heard the man's voice saying, "Pussy, where have you been, you stupid old fool? Oh, get down. Stop it, you clown." Cautiously, I opened my eyes, and the leopard was cavorting around the stranger, nudging at his hands and whining and grunting and mewing, and the man was laughing. "Where did you find him?" he asked us. Douglas was the first to find words. "In the grove on the moor," said he. Do you know him?" asked Joe. "He belongs to me." "But he's our hearthrug," said Jemima. "His name's Lammy." The man laughed again and stroked the leopard's head where it rested lovingly against his thigh. "I've had him since he was a baby," said he, "and his name's Pussy." We goggled at him. He was a youngish man, rather short and broad-shouldered. His face was good-natured, and he had bright blue eyes. He glanced around our circle and said more seriously,
"I'm very glad you did find him and looked after him. I was afraid he'd get hurt. He got out this morning when some idiot left his paddock gate unlatched, and there's been a bit of a hue and cry on. I've told them he's perfectly tame. But you know how it is when people get excited, and once a hunt starts..."
"All the men have guns," said Joe.
"And there's soldiers," put in Douglas.
"And police dogs," added Nigel.
"And Mr. Dobbs," said Missy broodingly.
"Have you got a zoo?" I said. "And did he eat someone at Muddiford?"
"No to both questions," and the man grinned widely. "He lives with me at Coombe Hinton as a pet, and he hasn't been brought up to eat people. He had a perfectly good breakfast this morning. What's more, I don't say he couldn't bite and claw," he added, "but only if he was frightened."
"What would be likely to frighten him?" I asked.
"Well, if anyone were afraid of him. Fear is catching, you know. It's very lucky for Pussy that none of you feared him."
"We like him," said Joe thinly.
"We thought he was our hearthrug," said Missy.
"Bless you," said the man vaguely.
During all this, he'd taken a collar from his pocket and put it around the leopard's neck, and now he coupled it to a chain leash. Douglas said, in a brisk voice, "There are men coming into the wood now, the ones from the moor."
"Oh, get him away," cried Joe. "Run."
"But they'll see I have him on a leash."
"They may shoot first and see that afterward."
"But I must explain to them."
"No, no," said my sister, frantic with worry. "Please run, get him safely away."
"All right, love," said the man. "My car is just out in the lane there. I'll let the police know in the village that he's found. I don't want a lot of excitement around Pussy anyway. It gives him hiccups." He gave us one of his cheerful grins and added, "Say goodbye to your friends, you hearthrug." And he let go of the leash. The leopard trotted to me. Just for a moment, I quailed. But I'd been playing with him the whole afternoon. I'd shoved him into a hoop and slapped him and shouted at him. I stroked his head, and he loped away to the others, purring. They all patted him, and Missy kissed the end of his nose. "Goodbye, lammy pussy," said she. "Be a good boy."
"Do please hurry," said Joe urgently.
"All right, come and have tea with us," said the man. "My name's Rivendell, Major David Rivendell, the little manor at Coombe Hinton, telephone 32." We said thank you, and he said no, thank us. And he went away with his leopard. I scarcely noticed their departure, for a thought had suddenly come to me, and it came as a shock. Suppose the hunters weren't after Pussy at all, but our escaped rug? I said, "We don't know now where the rug is, you know. It may be a tiger. It may have eaten that boy." Joe gave a gulp of dismay. Douglas said we'd better start looking for that, then. Nigel said we didn't know where to start, and he wanted his tea, and as far as he was concerned, the rug must look after itself. The first of the hunters walked into the clearing. It was Mr. Dobbs. He glared at us, as other men came up behind him. They all glared. "I told you kids to go home," said the farmer. "Have you lost your wits? There's a wild beast loose." I had to say something. I crossed my fingers in my pocket and said, "Not now there isn't. Major Rivendell has found it and taken it home on its lead. It's his, and it's tame, and if you go to the police station, they'll tell you." At least I was giving our rug a chance to get away, I thought. "Rivendell," said Mr. Dobbs. "Ah, he has got some wild creature in his house." "It's a leopard," said Douglas, and added scornfully, "Some people can't tell stripes from spots."
"Cheeky monkey," said Mr. Dobbs.
But the men had lowered their guns, and now they leaned on them, and discussed going on to the village and checking with the police, and one went back to the moor to tell the rest of the hunt. We went home. With the honors of war, I rather thought. And then I began to wonder what our rug was doing, and my spirits took a plunge. But the rug was back in the attic, squashed and drab and unrecognizable as ever. We all stared at it, with dropped jaws.
"How on earth?" I said.
Joe gave a shaky laugh. She said it must have happened after lunch, when we all went to sleep in the grove.
"Just a snooze," I said.
"At least 2 minutes, time enough," said my sister, "to make whatever it was into a rug again.
That means things have come back to where they started when the magic breaks.
Oh, she cried, I'm glad to see it. If it was being chased about and being frightened...
And eating people, said Douglas.
That wasn't true, said Nigel loftily. Don't you know when old de Dobbs is trying to be funny? I do. His ears twitch.
We should have guessed the leopard was a real one, said Joe. He didn't talk.
Missy cast herself suddenly on the rug and sneezed as the dust rose.
"Dear darling Lammie," she said, stroking it fondly.
"What was it, anyway?" I said.
"Try it again and find out," said Douglas.
We shut the doors and windows. We tried it again, but the rug remained a rug.
"I see," said Joe thoughtfully. "We can't use the Applestone twice on the same thing."
"Clever girl," said the Applestone.
"Anyway," said Douglas, "we know it was a sheep."
"A wolf," said Nigel.
"A bear," said Joe.
"A lamb. A deer."
And that's the end of chapter 3. See you next time.